Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, hope everybody's having a good weekend. It's Tony Bruschi, and this is our week in review where we take a look back at some of our most compelling segments of the week. Give you a chance to re-listen or catch up on stuff that maybe you missed. Enjoy.
This is a podcast that seeks justice. Justice for the lives stolen by those in society that hide amongst us every day. Hidden in our towns, cities, and countrysides, the places that we work, and sometimes in our very own homes. This is Hidden Killers.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Tony Bruschi. Thank you for listening. Be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our updates and discussions on the cases that we're following for you. Today, DNA. We hear about it all the time in all the cases that we are following, and I highly implore you to sit down, take a listen to this, remove the distractions in your life, and you're going to find some really interesting information in the next 24 minutes or so as we are going to be talking with Dan Crane. He's a forensic scientist and a professor, and he's really going to break down in detail what it is when we're talking about DNA evidence and how sometimes it can be like 10 quadrillion accurate, where it's like there's no doubt this is who this is from or this is how it matches. And it can be sometimes like 1 in 3. Where it's like, it could be you, or the next you, or the next. I mean, it's scary how accurate it can be and how inaccurate it can be at times. Not all DNA essentially is created equal when it comes to matching it to a criminal. Let's start there. Dan, let's just jump into this and let's talk about DNA profiling. And how you've said to me off the air, DNA profile says nothing about how or when DNA came to be associated with whatever is being tested.
You know, DNA test results are very powerful. And prosecutors love to get DNA evidence because I think the general public he expects that when they hear there's a DNA profile match, that they know whose DNA it was, and then they fill in the gap as to how it is that it got there. But the long and the short of it is that DNA tests themselves really can't tell us anything about how or when DNA came to be in the sample that got tested. The DNA could have been there for weeks or months prior to the sample being collected, weeks or months prior to there having been a crime committed. And it could have gotten there by very innocent means. A person of interest may have gotten their DNA on a victim of a crime, not by committing the crime, but by trying to render assistance to the person after the crime had been committed. Mm-hmm. The DNA test results would be absolutely the same, regardless of either of those two different scenarios. So what often happens is that one side or the other will present DNA evidence in a court case, and the jury will walk away thinking like, oh, well, that is the only explanation. Mm-hmm. And you know, they'll get the wrong impression as to what these test results can and can't say.
That's very interesting, because so many, I think from watching too much television, have the idea that, well, it's 100%. If the word DNA comes up and there's DNA matching, this must be our person. But that doesn't always necessarily lead to reality, though, correct?
Right, right. Well, and, you know, there's DNA matches, and then there are DNA matches, right? Some of them are a lot more impressive than others. And so pretty much from the beginning, back to the late 1980s and the early 1990s in the United States, our courts have expected that whenever there is a proclamation of a DNA match, that a statistic be attached to it. Because it's been appreciated, again, from the beginning, that the general public equates DNA profile match with absolute certainty, and yet some DNA test results are really equivocal. I've been involved in cases where the statistical weight was 1 in 3. Every third randomly chosen person would be expected to match just as well as the person of interest. And I've just been reviewing a case earlier today where the chance of a coincidental match was described as 1 in 1 centillion. A centillion is 1 × 10³ power.
My goodness.
There's an enormous range where you might get DNA test matches.
Let's back up there and help me understand that better. To have a DNA match that's 1 in 3. I mean, is that even valuable at that point where it could be that generic? I mean, we think DNA testing, we think very specific, you know, things. That's almost like saying a fingerprint is like, well, 1 in 3 people have a fingernail that you can, you know, you can actually cut. The other ones, they bit. You know, it's very, very generic. So walk me through that. What is the difference, and how is that where some DNA matches are that generic and some are pretty much spot on?
Well, I think it ultimately comes down to how much information you have to work with. And let's use license plates as an analogy.
Okay.
And maybe I don't even need to say anything more, right? I think the picture, you know, kind of fleshes out just by mentioning that. But, you know, if you have an eyewitness to a hit and run and they tell the police, look, I got a quick look at the license plate. I saw the first letter on the license plate was the letter J, mm-hmm. right? Well, you know, that's better than nothing, right? Mm-hmm. 1 in 3. Is better than nothing, but a whole lot better would be 3 letters and 3 numbers, because now we're starting to talk about enough information to be able to say, hey, that license plate is unique. There is no other license plate that has that combination of letters and numbers, and we can figure out exactly whose vehicle it was that was at the scene of that crime. And the same happens with DNA test results. Sometimes you get information from just one location on from an individual's DNA. Other times you get information from 23 different locations. And some test kits today even allow you to get information from more. The more information you have, the more impressive the number can be.
So every piece of DNA is going to be a little bit different depending on what you're getting. How is that different? How do you have a piece of DNA that doesn't have all 23 matching pieces on it and some have less? Is it the quality of what it is? Is that like the difference between touch DNA versus a blood drop? Help me understand that difference better.
Yes, that's a big part of it. The quality and the quantity of the material that you have to work with plays a very big role in terms of how much information you can get from a sample. But there are other things too. There are strategic decisions that are made in the process of testing with regard to, for instance, which test kit you use. Some test kits are very good at getting information from DNA that's been degraded. But the price you pay is you focus on a smaller number of locations. So you'll ultimately get less information, but you may get more information by focusing on these regions, which are more resistant to degradation than you would have gotten if you had used a kit that let you look at more locations but suffered more from degradation. You know, another thing that often plays a big role in reducing the weight that can be attached to a DNA test result is the presence of DNA from more than one person, so a mixed sample. Mm-hmm. And it gets even worse when the mixture might contain DNA from closely related individuals. So, you know, it's not hard to create a mixed DNA sample that is virtually impossible to interpret reliably. And that uncertainty ultimately ends up giving rise to a statistic like 1 in 3 that's not that impressive.
Is that just because of the limits of our current technology? And obviously it's gone pretty darn far. But is that because of where we sit right now? For example, if we were to say, be having this conversation 20 years from now, and we're talking about, well, this sample could only pick up this many points. This one can pick up 23. This one over here can pick up many more. And there's the pros and cons of using the different types of test kits. Are we going to be in a place where even the most minute type of pickup of DNA will be able to reveal more? Or is that more so because of what is left behind, not necessarily the technology?
You know, I think your use of the word minute just now is the key. We're currently getting DNA test results from samples that are pretty much right at the theoretical limit of what it is you would be able to get a DNA test result from.
Okay.
20 years ago, we needed hundreds, thousands, actually probably tens of thousands of cells to be able to generate a DNA profile. But today, DNA profiles can be generated pretty reliably from just a couple of cells, and in some instances, maybe even as little as a single cell. And that's the smallest unit that we have to work with when we're talking about a human being. And so, again, the test kits today are getting us results from those very, you know, the smallest amount that we imagine we'd be able to get a test result from.
That's very, very interesting. There's, of course, the databases that are out there, convicted offender databases. There's also your genetic DNA bases or databases that are out there. A lot of those collected through things like 23andMe and Ancestry and all of that. What measures are taken out there to prevent errors and contamination in those sort of databases where is the wrong DNA being matched to certain people, or how does that all work?
Yeah, boy, that's a question that I think asks for a 2-hour long answer.
Everybody stand by.
Yeah, right. Strap yourself in.
Yeah.
Right? So let me do what I can in just a few seconds, perhaps.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I think there are risks. There's I'm concerned that there are some missed opportunities to identify suspects with these convicted offender databases because of errors that are in those database entries. So let me just put it right out there, right? There are about just over 13 million people whose DNA profiles have been entered into and are maintained within a convicted offender database by the FBI. Mm-hmm. The process of generating those DNA profiles is similar, but not exactly the same to what it is that's done for a casework sample, so for a crime scene sample. But because these should be single source samples just from a single individual with an abundant amount of DNA, we expect that they should be pretty accurate. However, when on rare occasions laboratories have done pairwise comparisons of the DNA profiles in those databases, they have found that there are some indications, some pretty strong indications, that maybe as many as 1 in 100, probably more like 1 in 1,000 of those DNA profiles have been mistyped. So the DNA profile that ends up in the database is not the correct DNA profile for the person who gave a sample. And if nothing else, that represents a potential for a crime to go unsolved that could have been solved if that DNA profile had been entered correctly, right?
Sure.
You get a crime scene sample, you search the database, you don't get a match because the person who committed the crime is not in the database. You don't get a match because the person's in the database, but their DNA profile isn't quite right. And there are some pretty simple things that could be done to determine exactly what that error rate was and to determine what sort of things contribute to those errors. Are there some locations within the genome that seem to be more prone to those errors than others? Are there some laboratories or some technicians that seem to be more likely to make mistakes than others, right? But if we could figure those sorts of things out, we might be able to fix them. We might be able to train the technician better. We might be able to get better supervision in a lab that's error prone. We might be able to discount the results from a location that looks like it's more likely to be a source of error. And yet, those types of analyses just don't seem to have been done. And again, that's concerning. It's worrisome to me. I and a number of other researchers and scientists have drawn attention to this issue. And to date, the FBI has been keeping a really tight grip on those databases and haven't done the analyses themselves. And they're not inviting others to come in and do them for them.
Why don't they do that? Is that just kind of the bureaucracy of what we get into with some of those agencies? Or is there a reason why they wouldn't want to try and shore up this database to be more accurate?
Well, I can't imagine that they wouldn't want the database to be more accurate. You know, there's just no upside to that.
Sure.
Beyond that, I think that's a good question to ask the people who administer that database better than me. I'll speculate, and tell you, I think that, in some sense, knowledge is power, and they have the high ground here, right? I mean, the people who want to do these analyses are on the outside looking in, trying to persuade them to do something, and they're just in a better tactical position if they have control of that information. One thing that I've heard said is that they want to protect the genetic information, the identity of the people in these databases. And I don't know how persuasive I find that because, well, first, there have been thousands of individuals whose DNA profiles have been available on the internet for many decades now. And I don't know of anyone who says that any harm has come to any of those people whose DNA profiles have been out there. So, I can't imagine what harm I would cause you if I happened to know your DNA profile. I just don't know what I'd do with it.
I've heard that argument before of, I don't want that information out there. Like, well, what exactly are you going to do with it? The only thing, and I'll throw this by you because you could answer this better than anybody else. The only thing I could think of is if that information somehow got into the wrong hands, not necessarily the FBI who's trying to hunt things down, but let's say some sort of foreign power or something, and they were wanting to go after a certain strain of the DNA that may belong to an individual with these sort of traits in their DNA and engineered some sort of biological weapon that would target that specific type of individual. Is that a thing, or is that still something out of science fiction movie? Which I hope it is, because everything, that's in science fiction movies are pretty much coming true.
Well, let me just tell you, I don't think it's a thing.
Okay.
The locations that are used for DNA profiling purposes to match suspects to evidence samples, they've been pretty deliberately chosen and pretty successfully chosen to not be associated with things that might be targeted in the way you've just described.
Okay.
I've thought about this a fair bit. I just can't imagine what harm I would cause a person if I knew their DNA profile. You know, one person once suggested, well, couldn't you plant that DNA at a crime scene and get that person in trouble? And it's like, sure, but I could synthesize their DNA. If I knew their DNA profile, we could synthesize it in a laboratory. But you know what? That takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of forethought and effort, and it would cost a fair bit. You know what would be much easier is if I just got one of their used cigarette butts or a used straw.
Yeah.
And I left that at the crime scene.
Like the average, if you have a shady police department or something that would be doing something like that, probably doesn't necessarily have access to synthesizing DNA at their department to go in and do that sort of thing.
And it would leave one heck of a paper trail that would be hard to conceal.
Sure. Right?
Whereas a cigarette butt, those are easy to come by, right?
You had mentioned earlier about it could lead to a crime going unsolved if it was inputted incorrectly, simply by human error. Could it do the opposite, though? Could it end up matching someone to something that it wasn't them that was involved, but somehow this match came because of the error in input?
It that is possible, but it's much less likely.
Okay.
Because what will happen when there is a match to a DNA profile in a database between a crime scene sample at database DNA profile, those do need to be confirmed. So they will go back to the original individual and they'll retest their DNA. And so that solves that problem pretty neatly. Another reason that those samples get retested is for chain of custody considerations, because there's less of a concern about chain of custody when you're entering the DNA profile into the database. And yet there is a concern when you're talking about matching somebody to a crime scene sample. So the retesting pretty neatly solves the problem of somebody being falsely included. But the problem of a false exclusion can't be solved by retesting.
Sure. You had mentioned right at the beginning, if you're at the scene of a crime, let's say you walk into a place and there's a body there, insert who it may be. Just generically speaking, and you're, oh my gosh, I can't, but what's going on? You go over, you check for a pulse, do all the things that you might do when you're frantic in this sort of traumatic situation. You end up getting your DNA all over the place. More so touch, not necessarily that you cut yourself or something, but you get it around the scene in a place where you probably don't want your DNA to be. How does law enforcement decipher something like that? They show up, let's say, then to the crime scene. You're there. Like, I just walked in. I just saw this. And then it's like, well, they found your DNA all over the body. Is there easier ways of deciphering this was someone who was truly just a good Samaritan trying to help out versus this may be a suspect in our crime, especially when the next question is, we'd like to get a DNA sample from you, sir?
Yeah. Well, I think the very short answer is no. There is no good way to discern. And again, it's back to this idea that the presence of a profile doesn't say how or when it got there. Mm-hmm. The most extreme example is that a DNA test simply can't tell us if there was an act of rape or consensual sex. I mean, there's just the test results are going to look exactly the same. And the scenario you described, a victim's DNA could easily get all over somebody who was trying to render aid. just as that Good Samaritan's DNA could get all over the crime scene. There's just no difference between the DNA test result you would get for the one scenario as opposed to another.
Are we getting any closer? Will there ever be a time where there can be more of a timeline as to when the DNA was placed at a scene? I mean, there's so many things we can look at today and go, well, based on what we see here, this dried up soda looks like it's been here, and they can, you know, kind of do some sort of testing. I don't know what it would be, but I'm sure there's some sort of testing to say, well, based on this, it looks like it's been here for 7 days or whatever it may be. Can we do something like that with DNA where we can tell the length of time in which it's been exposed or sitting on another person, an object, or something of that nature?
Yeah, you know, it is conceivable. I can imagine theoretically some things that you might do, but I'll tell you, just don't hold your breath, right? This is not going to be something that comes to pass within the next couple of years. I think maybe several decades from now, mm-hmm. it'll be a possibility. And it may not be based on DNA. It may be things that are associated with the biological sample, like RNA molecules that are there that might help with discerning between blood and saliva and semen and muscle tissues. And it might be proteins. There may be some proteins that turn out to just not hang around very well once they leave the body. And by checking for their presence or absence, you may get some insights in terms of how long the sample was separated from a person. But again, these are, you know, this is, now we're getting into science fiction sorts of things. might be able to build a good plot around that sort of thing, but we are a long way from that being used in a courtroom.
Oh, hey, you know, Dan, we talked 4 weeks ago, I would have said you were crazy if the headlines were, there's mysterious bubbles floating around over us and we're having UFO commissions being put together this week. But hey, there's mysterious bubbles floating around us and there's UFO commissions being put together. So science fiction now, reality, probably at some point down the road, right?
Well, why don't we see if we can get some DNA off of those bubbles, huh?
Fascinating conversation, Dan, as always. I very much appreciate having you on the air. Dan Crane, a forensic scientist and professor, president and CEO of Forensic Bioinformatics and professor at Wright State University. If you like the show, be sure to press subscribe wherever you download podcasts. You don't miss any breaking updates and discussions on the cases that we are following for you right here. We do greatly appreciate that. You can get yourself a ad-free experience through Apple Podcasts when you become a premium member there right now. My name is Tony Bruschi. You can follow me on Twitter at TonyBPod. Until next time, for all of us, thanks for listening.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.